last lecture about graphene, but we're not going to completely abandon graphene. It's going to come back again. And we're skipping ahead a little bit, because what I want to talk about is how deformation of the lattice, something that you can get by pushing on the lattice and making it deform, can actually, in that kind of system, look as if there is an effective magnetic field. And why is that interesting? It's interesting because the application of magnetic field in the direction outside of the plane in a two-dimensional system is interesting by itself, and this is the subject of our next week, the quantum Hall effect. So let me just give you a little preview, and we'll talk about it more next week. But no matter what is your dispersion, or I guess it does matter to some degree, but any normal Fermi liquid in two dimensions that has some density of states as soon as you apply magnetic field, and let's say it's in the z direction, what you find is that this continuous spectrum of states actually collapses. And instead of that, you get discrete levels. So this is my energy, and I'm probing the density of states, how many states I have in each energy. And I get this discrete level. So all of the spectrum collapses, so there has to be massive degeneracy in each level. And then funny things happen when you measure things. You can imagine that you change the chemical potential, so you scan the spectrum, and you see what happens in between levels and on levels is very different. And we're going to discuss it more. In graphene, this is not exactly the picture, but still our Dirac cones collapse into discrete levels. In Fermi liquid, this distance is proportional to the magnetic field. In graphene, it's actually proportional to a square root of the magnetic field. And it's actually the one example for topology in condensed matter. But before that, let's just see if we can get something that looks like it without applying magnetic field. And the reason why it's interesting to get the same physics but not apply magnetic field is, well, first academic, but also you don't break the time reversal symmetry. So maybe the states could be a little different if you don't break the time reversal symmetry. And indeed, what I'm going to show you is going to be similar or analogous to the quantum Hall effect in graphene, but somewhat different. So first of all, why? Let's talk for a second about what is a gauge field in lattice system, because I want to start with a discrete system. Usually, we think of a gauge field as something like that. I want to add a phase to my wave function. And if my Hamiltonian is a quadratic Hamiltonian, I expect this phase to leave the Hamiltonian intact. So the Hamiltonian is invariant under this phase. So this is like a U1 phase. Of course, we can have SU2 symmetry is when you add something here that will change the spin. And this is a U1 rotation. So I add a phase to my wave function. And now, let's say I want to write my Hamiltonian that was some quadratic Hamiltonian with this new wave function, then it's just going to drop off. This phase will drop off. And of course, I can also gauge it. So let's say that this phi is not constant. So it's actually I phi of space times the wave function. Now, it depends on my matrix here. So if I have here derivatives, then I will have additional derivatives here, additional terms coming from taking a derivative of this function. And if I want to leave my my Hamiltonian invariant, I have to add another term to compensate for that. So this is the way a gauge field is related to that phase, basically. It comes to compensate. In a discrete system, I can again think of something like that. And usually, instead of a derivative, my operator would be something like CI dagger CJ, so some hopping. This is the kinetic energy in a discrete system. And therefore, what I will get when I do that, that I need to gauge, would be I, let's say, phi J minus phi I, something like that. And I can, of course, call that, if I want, e to the I, either ADR, if I wanna say that it's continuous. I can write it like that. So a gauge field comes in this way. You can look at it from the opposite direction. If I have magnetic field in my system, the way to insert it to a discrete Hamiltonian would be to take the hopping that I started with, so here I started with T CI dagger CJ, and make it into T e to the I AIJ, let's call it, which would be this CI dagger CJ. So this tells you immediately that the hopping and the gauge field are related. So if, for some reason, I can change the hopping amplitude, I might get something that looks kind of like a gauge field. Usually, the changing in amplitude due to deformation does not create something that looks like a gauge field. Because usually there would just be, let's say I have two atoms and I have two orbitals on them. If they come closer together, the overlap increases, but usually it doesn't become imaginary. So I will just have some, instead of this T, I will have some deformed T, T tilde. But in graphene, because of this linearization that we do around the nodes, as we'll see in a second, we actually get something that looks like a gauge field. So we can deform our crystal and create an effective magnetic field. And this is what we're going to do today. So first of all, let's think of a deformation. So I don't need that. So I want to know how T deforms. So the first thing I do is I say my T going from I to J is actually now T naught plus some gamma T dot UI minus UJ. So why am I writing that? So what I'm trying to say is that my hopping matrix has some dependence on the displacement of atoms. So for each atom I define this vector of displacement, telling me where it is. But now, sorry, this is not T. Let's call it tau, tau ij. So tau would be the vector that connects the two nearest neighbors. Okay? So, but why is this form correct? So what I want to say is that this is the hopping is some function of the distance. Let's say this is the distance, and actually let's say that it only cares about the absolute value of the distance. Let's call it d. So f of d. So I can expand and say that f of d is f naught plus some other linear term in the change in d, which is the displacement. So some f1, and this is what I want to calculate. So first I need to know how is the distance changing. So let's say this is atom I. This is the vector tau that takes me from I to j. And now I just want to write ui, say uj. I have two vectors of displacement. And now I'm looking at this vector d. What is this new distance d? So d is tau plus ui minus uj. Okay? So I have all of these. Three of those together, let's say, give me d. And I can write it roughly as, so actually this is equal exactly to tau squared, so now it's only magnitude, plus ui minus uj squared plus 2 tau dot ui minus uj. So this is just some vector equation. And what I'm going to do is actually approximate it by tau. I throw away this term, okay? So I'm assuming that my deformation is small compared to the distance between lattice sites. So I throw away this term, and then I have something like plus 2 tau dot ui minus uj over tau magnitude. Okay, so I just expanded. And now this is the small parameter. So f of d is just going to give me t naught. F1 is going to be a derivative of this function with respect to the distance at equilibrium, times the distance, the change in the distance, which is that. So all of these factors that I don't know, but are just a constant property of the material, I put in this gamma. And what is important for me is this directional dependence here in tau, which is the direction of the nearest neighbor, and the difference in displacements. Okay, so this is my tau. This is my hopping matrix. And now I want to go a step further and say the following. And this is not a trivial step, but people worked it out and showed that it actually is correct. So I just want to say, and even though these two are on different lattices, I want to take ui to be u of r, to be a continuous function. So this is a vector function of position. And you can imagine that atoms don't really move individually. There are forces between them. So this is an assumption here. And then what I want to say is that, therefore, ui minus uj will be any one of them, I would say, so this is u of ri, u, let's say, you're not, this is not a good idea. So let's say that the position u, not just measured from r, but the position u is going to be to first order ri plus du dr at ri times let me just think about how I want to say that. Yeah, I want to say something else. I want to say that the distance ui minus uj is basically also in the direction tau times u. Okay, so I want to say that I'm taking a first order expansion here, and the zeroth order is the equilibrium, which gives me T, and I don't care about. The next order is this. Okay, so what does that mean? It's still a vector equation, but just it looks like that. So it will be, tau x will be tau x dx ux plus tau y dx dy ux, and then tau x dx uy plus tau y dy uy. Okay, so this is what I mean by putting these brackets. So it's just like doing a Taylor expansion, but for a vector. So I do it for each component separately, and also because it's a vector function, it's a function of a vector, I have to take the gradient. So for each component, the first term in the expansion is going to be a gradient. There's actually a coefficient that I'm neglecting. So this is the notation. And now all we have to do is figure out what is this addition. So let's call that delta t. So this tells me that delta t is actually gamma tau dotted into tau dot grad of u. And I don't know if it helps you in terms of indices. You can always write it as tau nu d nu u mu. Does that help? I don't know if from other field theories here, so can write it this way. And now what I want to do is basically show you how this can give me something that looks like a gauge field. So now don't forget that this u is a function of space. So it's a deformation. And every time you go somewhere in your plane, it gets a different value.
Yeah. What happens to the energy band as we make this deformation?
We're gonna see. So this is what we're looking at. If it was something, some constant, I would say not much. It just changes the magnitude, the overall magnitude of t. But this is something that is actually breaking our symmetry. And something very drastic actually happens to the energy band. So now let me do one more thing actually before we go on. Yeah. So now there's an interesting point. If it was just a lattice, then I know what Tij goes into. But I want to work at low energies. And before, when we worked at low energies, do you remember what we did? How did we go into our low energy Hamiltonian that looked like Dirac? We Fourier transformed, right? But then we found that there are special points in the Brillouin zone where we should be concentrating in, because the energy is low only there. Okay, only at these points we have low energy excitations. So now we know that these are important points, and even though we added a perturbation that breaks the translational invariance, I still want to work next to these points. So what I do is the following. I'm assuming that whatever wave function I have is close to the Dirac point. So it's like k dot r times some other function. U is not a good good notation here. So let's say psi and chi, okay? So this is kind of I can think of it as separation of variables. So before, I had plane waves. When I had translational invariance, this was just e to the I, k dot r. But k was actually the close to the valley. So I had big K, and I had a little q here. So if q is small, it induces some variations on a longer length scale. So for a large K, I think of something that's rapidly oscillating in space. Big oscillations. But when q is small, it's just another perturbation that's on a much larger length scale. Now, if I don't have translational invariance, I don't write this, but I'm assuming that the large oscillations are still there. I don't know this particular function, but I do know that I have a large oscillatory part that goes like that. So this is a kind of perturbation theory statement. I want to go close to the nodes in energy, and I'm assuming that the states are still close to the nodes in momentum space, which is that. So now I need to apply my new hopping on this kind of situation. So I have the following terms. So my let's say I and tau. So I'm going over all sites with and all of the nearest neighbors tau, and T C I C J goes to the let's call it E naught that we had before plus I tau. And now I want to write it this way. I will have my delta t, which depends on tau and depends on position, times e to the I k dot tau. And I'll still have those wave functions. I still have the wave functions that I had before. But they're somewhat modified by the fact that I went to the nodes. Okay? And I have e to the k tau here because of the two phases from here almost canceled, but since I and j are separated by tau, I'm left with this. Okay? And now all I want to do is just calculate this and sum it over tau to see what my my gauge field is. Okay, so let's do that. So I want to sum over tau of the following quantity. I want to take tau x, tau y, dot with this. And I want to write it in a different way. So it's going to be tau x, uxx, plus tau y, uxy, and tau x u x y plus tau y u y y times e to the I k dot tau. Okay, so what I wrote here looks like some simplification. So basically, I denoted, let's say, u mu nu by du mu d nu. Okay? And it looks like I looked at mu and nu as being symmetric. For example, here I think I should have had u, y, x, and I replaced them. And the reason is that I think of this displacement as being a gradient of some other scalar function. So I'm thinking that u is grad f. So therefore, u mu is d mu f, some other function. And therefore, u mu nu is just a second derivative. And why am I thinking of that as a gradient? You can think of this deformation as a response to some pressure. Or you can think of it as, you know, a force that's coming from some scalar energy change. And therefore, I get that. So the only step that might be non-trivial is the fact that I can replace the order of derivatives. But I can do it if it's really a derivative, if this is really my form. So this is another assumption I'm making. Yes, Olga.
C dagger and C over there, they're not indexponential, are they?
Sorry?
These ones over there, they're not indexponential, are they?
No, I'm sorry, they're not. So I think in this course I can safely say that I'm not going to put too many operators in the exponent, but it does happen sometimes. Especially if you want to build coherent states of spins, you have to put creation operators in the exponent. But we're not going to do that. So now let me just calculate this. So let me remind you our setup. So we have our Brillouin zone. And we can just choose a point where we want to work. So let's say this is k. This is k prime. So let's just, for now, work at k. And now, this really depends on sublattice. So if you remember, we have sublattice A. Its neighbors are, let's call it tau 1, tau 2, and tau 3, takes you from A to its neighboring B sites. The just a second, the B sublattice has the exact opposite picture. Yeah. They do, and I'm going to drop it because the tildes just mean that I've specified in the nodes, in the Dirac points. So these are still creation operators, and they still create an electron at site I, but it also creates an electron at site I where its momentum is close to the Dirac point. But I'm going to drop it from now on and just think of it as my spectrum that's already been linearized. So now, as you know, Hamiltonians are Hermitian, so I don't have to worry about, you know, whether I have something that depends on the gauge field here. Whatever it is, I'm going to get the complex conjugate here. So I'm just going to work with lattice A going to its neighbors on the B sublattices. So what are these vectors? In my notation, this length to the next unit cell I call A, so this length is A over root 3. And the tails I have, let's write them in a convenient place. So the tails I have are tau 1 is 1 over root 3 in the y direction. Tau 2 is half x minus 1 over 2 root 3 y. And tau 3 will be minus half x minus 1 over 2 root 3 y. Okay, so these are just these vectors. And all I have to do now is find the relevant phases for each tau and write this all down. It's a little lengthy, but it's worth it. So for each one of them, let's make a table. For each one of them, e to the I k tau looks different. So I choose k to be, k is 4 pi over 3, 0. Okay, so it's this point in the Brillouin zone. And now I just have to calculate. So this tau is on the y direction, so k dot tau is 0. This is x, so it's just giving me e to the 2 pi I over 3. And this gives e to the minus 2 pi I over 3. Okay? And now let me just do this sum. So, I guess you can't see if I go too much back. And there's a dot here, so I have to take this times this plus this times that. So for the first vector, tx is 0. I don't have to worry about it. So I just have ty. And ty is 1 over root 3. And I have another ty here. So I have 1 over 3 uyy. Now, and no phase. Okay? Now, the second vector, I have half times half uxx plus root 3 over 2 uxy. That's it with a half plus square root 3 over 2 half uxy. Plus, sorry, there's a minus. 3 over 2 uyy. And I have another one that's pretty, oh, and not to forget, e to the 2 pi I over 3, e to the minus 2 pi I over 3. And I have another value that is pretty similar, but it has minus half. And here, minus half uxx. Minus root 3 over 2 uxy. The phase is opposite. And let me go on here. Oh, this is also a minus, right? Because it's ty, which is minus, minus 1 over 2 root 3. And also here, 1 over 2 root 3, not 3 over 2. Yeah, sorry about that. Okay. Minus 1 over 2 root 3 times minus half u xy minus 1 over 2 root 3 uyy. So this is it. And now let us just collect the terms, or maybe first check that it's right before we go on. Okay. We'll assume it's right and hopefully not find more mistakes. So let's just collect. So what is the coefficient of uyy? It has a third from here. It has 1 over 1 over 4 root 1 over 12, okay? Here, from here, and then another e to the 2 pi I over 3 e to the minus, yeah, and phase missing. Plus, from this term, I have plus of the same thing, e to the minus 2 pi I over 3. Okay? So this is uyy plus uxy, uxx. So uxx has a quarter. So let me just combine. It has a quarter here plus a quarter here of two opposite phases. So it has actually half cosine of 2 pi over 3. And is this everything that we have for uxx? Yeah? Plus uxy times. Again, I think I have two similar looking terms, but now with opposite signs. And okay, and also let me collect everything. So the coefficient that I have here from these two, yeah, it doesn't cancel. So I have minus 1 over 4 square root of 3. And I have this phase, but I have the same phase with opposite sign from the other two terms here. So I have 2i sine of 2 pi over 3. Okay? So this is 2 times cosine 2 pi over 3. Cosine 2 pi over 3 is cosine of minus 60, which is half, minus a half. Oh, I think there might be a sign error. Yeah, let me see. I think I might have a sign error somewhere. Oh, yeah, yeah. So there's a minus sign. I think that's fine. Minus 12. And I have a 2 here from the 2 cosine. Okay, so let me just write it down. So for uyy, I have a third I think I have a 4 here. Okay, I'll just write it down. So I basically will have a third minus 1 over 6, which is minus 3, 2, 6. Yeah, is that right? For uxx, I have a quarter. For some reason, I have factors here wrong. So quarter of cosine of 2 pi over 3. And this cosine is root 3 over 2. This cosine is minus a half. So I have some trouble somewhere, but I know that this has to be a quarter. Okay, so forgive me about that. I don't know.
That's right.
That's right. It's always good to know the final result. And then, so I have this, and then uxy, I have I times a half, or maybe minus I times a half. So the I actually comes from the sign here. So now you see, I told you before that when atoms come closer or something like that, the overlap just changes by magnitude. It's not the case here when we go to the nodes. So it's only because of the nodal approximation that we're getting some phases, and our result is actually imaginary in some sense. So basically, what we got is the following, that to replace our Hamiltonian, let's say we just call it psi, grad psi that we had before, or grad dot sigma psi. So for the off-diagonal term, we had minus ih dx minus I dy. So now we have to add in these things. So to the x derivative, I'm going to add the real part, which would be uxx minus uyy. And I call that ax. Okay, and I'm dropping a coefficient of minus a quarter. And to to the imaginary part that I have here, I'm going to add the imaginary part of the displacement and result, and it's going to be my ay, which is I uxy times 2 compared to those. So I found that I can represent everything with this kind of gauge field that comes from the strain, if you want, in the system. And now the question is, so this is nice, and maybe that's a framework that one can talk in general about deformations. I'm not sure it's easier or harder than just taking the lattice version and adding phonons. But if you think about it, if this is really a good description, then when I add phonons, I even have something that changes in time. So it's like I coupled my Dirac fermions to a gauge field that even has time dependence. So I created something that might look like UD3, or depending on the kinetic term of the phonons, would look like different things. So I saw in the literature some suggestions. I'm not sure they're very useful, but maybe nice analogies can come. But let me specify a certain gauge field that can give us a certain deformation, that gives us a gauge field that is related to a constant magnetic field in the z direction. And the reason I want to do that is that I want to get to the quantum Hall effect state. Any questions? It's very simple. So all I did here is I'm imagining that instead of hopping, I want to take a derivative, because this is what we do when we linearize. And then I'm asking, okay, but when I go in a certain direction, I don't only take a derivative, I have this annoying piece that I got from the deformation. So what is this piece? I have to sum it up in to all of the bonds. And then I saw that it has both a real and imaginary part. So I say, OK, since the real part is related to the motion in the x direction in the way I formulated this Hamiltonian just because of this Dirac, I'm going to call that ax. And the imaginary part, I'm going to call ay. But it's the total effect of the deformation on my lattice. But now let me just show you that actually we can go on and get a constant field. Can I erase all of that? So it turns out, maybe not surprisingly, that if we choose a strain field, so let's call that U strain field, that has a rotational symmetry in the plane that is threefold. So a discrete rotational symmetry, not a full rotational symmetry, means that if I rotate by 2 pi over 3 how many times I want, this field is going to be still the same. If I choose that kind of strain, I get the constant magnetic field that I want. So it's easier for me to think about it in terms of radius and angle. So just in polar coordinates, I define a vector in the direction of the radius and a vector perpendicular to it. And it turns out that if I choose this to be C, some constant C, R squared, let's say this would be the sine 3 theta. So you see already that this is rotationally invariant. And here I'll just take cosine 3 theta. Then I get a constant magnetic field. So to get to ux and uy, what I need to do, so let me just write it this way. We want ux and uy, which will take derivatives to get uxx, uyy, and uxy. We just need to undo this polar coordinate thing. So cosine and minus sine. Yeah. And sine and cosine of u theta. So I just want to undo that to see what I get. And yeah, we have a little bit of time. So let me just do that. So here, I'll just get cosine theta CR squared multiplying everything, cosine theta sine 3 theta minus sine theta cosine 3 theta. And here I'm going to get sine theta cosine 3 theta plus cosine theta sine 3 theta. And I can, and this is just sine of theta minus 3 theta, actually minus, I think, but it doesn't matter. And this one is, oh, wait just a second. Yeah, I made a mistake here. So this is sine, and this is cosine. So this would be cosine of 3 theta minus theta. So sine of 2 theta is 2 sine theta cos theta. And if I have r squared here, then r sine theta would be y, and r cos theta would be x, so 2yx. And here, this would be cosine of 2 theta, which is cosine squared of theta minus sine squared of theta, which with the r squared will give me x squared minus y squared. So I got something that looks like that. My A is some constant, which I don't care which is 2xy and then x squared minus y squared. Sorry, this is not A. This is U. And now A, we have the prescription to get A. So I take, let's say, uxx. I take the derivative, I get, so uxx is 2cy. uyy is I take this derivative here, and I get minus 2cy. So ax would be 4cy. Ax is 4cy. And uxy, which is related to ay, so let's say it's 2i uxy, is 2ic. And then take the derivative here, x. And if you take the curl of this, you'll just find that it's constant. Okay? Because you'll have to take dA x dy, which is a constant, minus dAy dx. So I think it's something like 2c. I don't know if they add up or subtract. But it's just proportional to that constant you started with. So basically, we were able to get a constant magnetic field. So we have an effective magnetic field. One thing that I said before is that this field will not break the time reversal symmetry. But if it just looks like a gauge field, it does break the time reversal symmetry. So what's the way out? Do you have any idea? So do you know what the time reversal does? So let's say I have a state. Now I want to reverse the time on the state. What do I need to do? So I need. So let's say I have my state, which is, you know, something that I applied on the vacuum. So this is my state. I had a vacuum and I created an electron somewhere with momentum k. Now I want to apply time reversal symmetry. So let's call it big theta. What do I get? What do I need to reverse? I need to reverse the momentum. Right? Because if I'm going with some velocity in some direction, time changes direction, I'm going back. So I need to take c minus k. And I have to change the spin. The spin is angular momentum. So it also has, it's also odd. So our gauge field actually doesn't care about spin. So even if we change the spin, we will still end up with the same magnetic field. But don't forget that we already gave all of our electrons some momentum. They can have more momentum around there, but we defined all of our momentum to be around here. Now, if I take k to minus k, I also have to reverse this. So I go to this k, to the other valley. But in the other valley, my Hamiltonian actually looks different. In my other valley, instead of kx plus iky that I had here, I actually had to add a minus sign that actually changes the way I couple to sigma. And eventually, it means that I change my gauge field, because my gauge field doesn't depend on where. Oh, actually, it depends on where I am through this factor e to the I tau dot k. So that will be k prime here. So some, everything is going to have a minus sign with respect to before. And I have this minus sign. And eventually, it turns out that whatever field you have in the k, you'll have minus that field in the other valley. So overall, you do not break time reversal symmetry. Because even if you feel a magnetic field that, you know, wants to boost your momentum in some direction, when you when you go to the other node, you're boosted in the other direction. So there are still time-reversed pairs on these two sides of our Brillouin zone. So, okay, maybe I didn't say that. But when a system is time reversal, it means that for every excitation, there is another excitation which is degenerate in energy that is the time reverse pair. We call it the Cramer's pair also. So it has opposite momentum and opposite spin. And sometimes other quantities, but we only have that. So to preserve the time reversal symmetry would be to apply a different sign of magnetic field on the Cramer's pairs. So the way to see that is just to think of the magnetic field as some boost to your momentum. And if you boost everything in a certain momentum, say that I boosted everything in a certain momentum through a gauge field, then now K and minus K are not on two sides of zero. I cannot reflect around zero and get to the same point. Okay? Is that understood, or should I try to say that again? I'll just say it again. So you can think of a magnetic field through a gauge field. And let's say I have this constant. I can always, for B in the Z direction, I can always choose A to be, let's say, a 0x times B. And if I look at it as a phase, it looks like I'm shifting all of my momenta. Because I have, instead of e to the I k dot x, I'm going to have the gauge field here. And then I'm creating a mismatch between time-reversed pairs, because they're both shifted in the same direction. Here, it's not the case. And we didn't explore what happens far away from the Dirac points, let's say somewhere here. So if our function is positive here and negative here, it must go to zero somewhere in the middle of our hexagon. But it's in a smooth way connecting the two valleys, but in opposite directions. In terms of the energy, actually, it turns out that it doesn't matter which valley you are in for the spectrum, but the wave functions do care about the direction of the magnetic field. So to make that a bit more concrete, you're going to have an assignment about the quantum Hall effect in graphene. And I think, Dennis, when are we giving that? On Monday or Thursday? Tuesday, okay. Oh, okay, that's right, yeah. So it will be a tutorial. So we'll first do the quantum Hall effects in a parabolic system, and then in the tutorial we'll do it for graphene. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
So you're creating something like a magnetic field in the system that's related to a strain field in the crystal. Like, what's causing that?
The strain?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you for asking that, because I didn't relate that to some experiment that I showed you. So this was first a theoretical proposal. Let's do that. And this strain profile that I gave you that has this rotational symmetry is not something that happens naturally. There is strain that just comes from phonons. Phonons deform your lattice. And that can be maybe described by a gauge field. But if we want this situation, we can actually engineer it. And I think I showed you in the first lecture, but maybe was out of context then, that there were experiments that actually created bubbles of graphene. So you can make graphene freestanding without a substrate by, you know, attaching it to something here. Usually the way it's done is that there is some substrate, and then it's etched away later, and only in two places there's some other material that is holding it. Now, there was a clever experiment by the Cromi group in Berkeley where they took a substrate and they added a bubble of something, some blob, which had the right shape. And then they grew the graphene on top of it and then etched it away. So we had exactly the correct kind of strain as the theoretical suggestion on our graphene. And then they took the STM tip and just measured the density of states. And what they found is hopefully what you will find in the tutorial, that instead of this density of states of graphene, the spectrum actually looks like that, something like that. And they actually cannot tell you from the strain, from first principle, exactly what is the magnetic field. But what they can do is measure the positions of these peaks and infer the magnetic field. And you might know that magnetic fields that we can make in the lab are up to 60 Tesla, maybe 100. They can get to 600 Tesla. So potentially there's something more interesting if you go to higher and higher fields. So this is remarkable. I think there are some issues that it's not totally proven that it's as simple as the theory. For example, we'll learn about magnetic length, which is how big is are the eigenstates, which are relatively localized in the quantum Hall effect. And this bubble is somewhat too small to accommodate it. So it looks like what they're measuring is not just Landau levels, but maybe some mesoscopic physics from the fact that you're constraining your Landau levels to be inside this bubble. But still a beautiful experiment. And another one that's pretty inspiring is completely by accident, the group of Nai Chang Ye from Caltech grew graphene on some other material, on copper, at high temperatures, and then cooled it down. And it turns out that the copper likes to shrink when you cool it down, but the graphene likes to expand it when you cool it down. And what was created is many of these nanobubbles. And also there, when you do a measurement of the density of states, you find things that are somewhat reminiscent of the Landau level spectrum. Now, that's even more controversial because these bubbles are much smaller. Yeah.
Okay, just a quick announcement. In the homework, and that's not the homework you received yesterday, the last part F is optional. Yeah.